An economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, it is working that way. The House Intelligence Committee investigating President Trump's ties to Russia met today behind closed doors and voted to send transcripts of witness interviews to Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Chairman and local Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff joins us now. Hi.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Great to have you back. Well, why did you vote to send those transcripts to Robert Mueller?
Well, some of the transcripts he has not had a chance to see yet. We want to share what evidence we were able to obtain with the Special Counsel and the Department of Justice. But other transcripts he has had access to, but nonetheless wasn't permitted to use for different purposes. So if, for example, the special counsel wanted to bring further perjury cases or false statement case or obstruction, we want to make sure that he can use the full testimony for whatever purpose he sees fit. And as well, if he wishes to include some of the testimony in whatever report he is producing, we have authorized that purpose as well.
And he has already leveled perjury and obstruction of justice charges against two witnesses who testified before your committee, and that would be Roger Stone and Michael Cohen, right?
That's exactly right.
Who else testified who he might be interested in?
You know, I don't want to go through particular witnesses, but we certainly have been concerned in a couple of regards, concerned at times with whether people were being truthful, but also a concern that witnesses refused to answer whole categories of questions, publicly represented how cooperative they were being, but privately refused to answer very pertinent questions. A couple of the challenges that we've had with respect to the latter, those that simply refused to answer, will now be in a position to compel them to answer something that the Republicans in the last couple of years had been unwilling to do.
Who refused to answer a whole category of questions?
Steve Bannon, for example, refused to answer a whole series of questions about his time during the transition, the administration, even after he left the administration. But other witnesses, likewise, stonewalled us. Donald Trump Jr., for example, refused to answer questions about his discussions with his father about that false statement that they reportedly produced about the meeting in Trump Tower in New York, where they falsely represented it was a meeting about adoptions. In that case, Don Jr. made a fallacious argument that he had some attorney-client privilege to protect his discussions with his father. We don't think that makes much sense. But the Republicans have been unwilling to compel answers, and we'll be going through all the witnesses who testified and deciding who we got to bring back.
So in that case, would you bring back Donald Trump Jr. and get him to compel him to answer these questions?
He is certainly one of the witnesses that we are considering. I don't want to go through which witnesses we've decided to bring back at this point, but we'll be looking at all of those who, because they were here voluntarily and because the Republicans refused to use a subpoena, could simply say, I'd rather not answer that question. That's no way to conduct an investigation.
Well, speaking of Donald Trump Jr., you were suspicious about that these phone calls that he made after that Trump Tower meeting, where actually the conversation was about dirt on Hillary Clinton's campaign, these Russians promising to deliver that to him. And when Republicans were running your committee, they refused to subpoena the phone records to see whom he might have called. But and you thought it could have been his father. But now that the records are out, it turns out the calls were made to a couple of business associates. So was that disappointing for you? And does it bolster President Trump's assertion that he knew nothing about that meeting?
We actually are not in a position yet to determine whether those public reports are accurate because the Republicans refused to seek the phone records. We will be seeking them, so we'll be in a position to determine who Don Jr. was talking to around the same time he was making arrangements to get dirt on Hillary Clinton from the Russians. But, you know, it is important to point out that those who have watched father and son during the campaign closest felt that the discussions he was likely to have with his father took place in person and not over the phone. Steve Bannon was quoted as saying, in fire and fury, that there was zero chance the son did not inform his father about that meeting, and that was done in person. So we intend to get to the bottom of it. Our job is not to predetermine the facts, but to find the facts and inform the public whatever they show.
Now, you asked Devin Nunes to recuse himself when he was leading the committee, and there was some concern that he was providing some intelligence to the White House about the investigation. Are you concerned that there was some kind of malfeasance there, and will you investigate it?
Yeah, there were certainly a number of very troubling actions taken by the then majority, including the then chairman, Nunes. And, you know, probably foremost among those was the now infamous midnight run, where he went to some undisclosed location and claimed to have seen evidence of an unmasking or surveillance conspiracy by Obama vis-a-vis the Trump campaign. None of that was accurate. But the place that he went to, that undisclosed location, was in fact the White House. And that certainly blew up the bipartisan cooperation on the committee. We are inviting the Republicans to rejoin the investigation, which they decided about 9 months ago was over, that there was nothing to see. Now, subsequent to that, we found out just how ill-considered that decision was, as we've learned that witnesses had testified falsely before a committee, that documents exist that they said didn't exist, that we still need to obtain, that people we had to have concern, like Maria Butinin, turned out to be Russian agents, that the Moscow-Trump Tower deal that also concerned us went on far longer than we knew. We have seen ample evidence of why it was so deserved the public for the Republicans to try to shut down the investigation. We hope they rejoin us, and at the same time, we're going to be careful to make sure that no one interferes or tries to obstruct the work that we're doing.
So are you saying that it's possible you would continue to investigate without any of the Republicans participating on your committee?
You know, it's my expectation that they will rejoin the investigation. I think they're giving every indication that they plan to do that. I think they recognize that it was a mistake. At least it was a mistake if your goal is to find the facts. If your goal is to defend the president, then it may have made sense. But we expect that they will rejoin the investigation.
Michael Cohen was scheduled to testify before your committee this week, and that's been postponed. How come?
We did so in the interest of the investigation. I can't comment beyond that.
Because the other time previously that he postponed his testimony before another committee, he said it was because the president was threatening him. It was for security concerns. Is it similar this time?
Mr. Cohen is cooperating with us. We fully expect him to continue cooperating with us, and we appreciate that. But I really can't comment further than that.
And when will all of the transcripts of the witness testimony before your committee be made public?
The intelligence community has told us that, you know, their estimate in completing the transcripts would probably go into May or June. The Republicans had said, we don't want any of them back until you give us all of them back. We're going to go back to the intelligence community to try to accelerate that timetable by prioritizing certain transcripts that we hope to release soon. So we hope to do that in an expeditious way.
Okay. And finally, what is the next avenue for your investigation? What are you going to be looking at next?
Well, we today announced the parameters of our investigation, which are very broad. But the central theme of what we're going to be looking at is the need to make sure from a counterintelligence point of view that no foreign power, whether it's Russia or a Gulf nation or any other party, China, has any kind of financial leverage over the president of the United States or his family, such that it could warp U.S. policy in a way that is not in America's interest. So that's our charter, and obviously Russia is going to be front and center of that. But if any foreign power has used financial inducement or entanglement to coerce the president or provide incentives to he or his family to act in ways that are not in our interest, we intend to ferret it out.
So that sounds like an expansion of the initial line of inquiry, because initially it was just Russia, right?
Initially, our investigation looked at Russia, but we have counterintelligence concerns given the opaque character of the president's finances, is unwilling to be transparent about any of it, and the actions of the administration that there may be more driving American policy than American interests.
Countries like Saudi Arabia you're interested in?
We have a particular concern with Saudi Arabia and how much the administration has deferred to Saudi Arabia. Also, though, the statements the president has made in the past about how much money he gets from Saudi Arabia and how much he therefore loves the Saudis. And again, if that's what's driving U.S. policy, that's a problem. And we need to expose the full extent of that problem, because we have heard contradictory things from the president. At times we've heard contradictory things from the president's family. You know, along similar lines, the president is now denying financial interest with the Saudis, but then he denied financial interest with the Russians at a time when he was pursuing what would have been the most lucrative deal, likely of his entire career, one that, according to the special counsel's office, would have made him and his family hundreds of millions of dollars, and that was the Trump Tower in Moscow.
And so you will try to get your hands on his tax returns?
I would expect that the Ways and Means Committee will have the priority over the tax returns.
Mm-hmm.
And we're certainly sharing with the Ways and Means Committee our interest and concern about what those might shed light on in terms of any foreign financial interests. But those will be first and foremost a decision for the Ways and Means Committee.
All right, Congressman Adam Schiff, Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Immigration was, unsurprisingly, a major part of the president's speech last night.
Now is the time for Congress to show the world that America is committed to ending illegal immigration and putting the ruthless coyotes, cartels, drug dealers, and human traffickers out of business.
The president still insisting on billions in funding for his border wall. Congress has about a week and a half to figure something out, or the government could shut down again. Here to help us fact check some of the president's immigration claims in his address last night is Politico's Ted Hessen. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. All right. Well, let's start with the president's first claim that large caravans are on the march to the border again and that governments in Mexico are helping them.
We have just heard that Mexican cities, in order to remove the illegal immigrants from their communities, are getting trucks and buses to bring them up to our country in areas where there is little border protection.
Okay, Ted, is that true?
The president is correct that there is a large group of migrants who are in northern Mexico right now across the border from Eagle Pass, Texas. But what is not correct is the implication that they're preparing to do something illegal. I mean, many of the migrants who are coming to the border are actually planning to seek asylum under existing U.S. law and existing processes.
And that this idea that the Mexican cities are actually helping them, chartering buses and all that?
You know, I did see news reports that migrants took buses to the border. It didn't appear from those reports that it was the case that the Mexican government was involved in that. And actually, it was the opposite. At the border, there was actually Mexican officials with an imposing show of force that greeted the migrants when they arrived in the northern city in Mexico. So I think that, you know, there's not the implication that they're assisting the caravan migrants who are there now.
Okay. He went on to say that while the wealthy politicians and donors push for open borders, that's a direct quote, it's working class families who are the ones who suffer.
Working class Americans are left to pay the price for mass illegal immigration, reduced jobs, lower wages, overburdened schools, hospitals that are so crowded you can't get in, increased crime, and a depleted social safety net.
Okay, a lot of claims there, and there's been a lot of research into what the effects of immigration are on the American economy. Can you outline what the results are?
Well, that's right. There has been a lot of research into this, and what they've found is that immigration, both legal and illegal, in general does not have a big effect on wages. And there was, in particular, a 2016 study that was quite comprehensive that looked at that and found what other researchers have found in the past, that there aren't great effects on wages. And when there are, they tend to be on certain groups that would be prior immigrants to the U.S. who would maybe be competing directly with new immigrants for jobs, and also U.S.-born people who lack a high school diploma. So there are some effects on wages, but they're just not as big as what the president made them out to be in the speech.
What about on crime? He also says that illegal immigration increases crime, and last night he threw out these statistics.
Human traffickers and sex traffickers take advantage of the wide open areas between our ports of entry to smuggle thousands of young girls and women into the United States and to sell them into prostitution and modern day slavery.
Now, he says that quite frequently. He talks about women being tied up with duct tape over their mouths. And what are the facts when it comes to this idea of human trafficking?
What you hear from anti-trafficking groups is that's not the reality, that it's more likely that foreign people that are trafficked would actually come to the U.S. on a visa. So, you know, a border wall wouldn't stop that and wouldn't have any effect on it. And there was actually a coalition of 80 different anti-trafficking organizations that sent a letter to members of Congress yesterday, really stressing that they stick to the facts in this debate and not be sidetracked by the kind of language that the president's throwing out.
And then drugs. He also talked about lots of drugs being brought across the border, illegal drugs. Are they smuggled between these legal checkpoints?
I mean, that's another good point. There have been several reports by the DEA that have said that drugs tend to actually come in through, the legal checkpoints, so through ports of entry. And the most common way or a typical way that they've described in these reports is to disguise it in cars, to hide it in different compartments, or even to bring it in with lawful goods that are coming through and kind of mix it into that cargo. There is a small amount of hard drugs that come through between ports of entry, but according to these Drug Enforcement Administration reports, that's just a small percentage, and it's more rare than coming through the ports of entry.
To prove his point that there should be a wall built along the border and that they work, he pointed to the city of El Paso last night.
The border city of El Paso, Texas, used to have extremely high rates of violent crime, one of the highest in the entire country, and considered one of our nation's most dangerous cities. Now, immediately upon its building, with a powerful barrier in place, El Paso is one of the safest cities in our country. Simply put, walls work and walls save lives.
And the president also pointed to San Diego as an example of walls saving lives. Is that true that the walls serve to cut down on crime in those two cities?
In the case of El Paso, you have a city that has been historically safe for years. And I know that some residents pushed back on the president's statements last night in regards to safety. And I think one really important thing to remember is that undocumented immigrants and immigrants in general do not commit crimes at a greater rate than native-born people in the U.S. And that's been borne out time and time again in studies. So that's a central theme of what the president is trying to say here, and it's just not correct.
I mean, it sounds like we've gone over most of what he said during the speech on immigration. It sounds like most of his points are at best misleading.
I mean, these are things he's repeated time and time again, going back to his 2015 campaign. And, you know, they're at best misleading and they're oftentimes just incorrect or not true. But that being said, you can tell that he's not budging off this worldview. I think some people have expected the president to pivot at some point and to maybe adopt a different tone on immigration. But you know what? He hasn't pivoted, and he's basically taking the same tone that he's taken since back in 2015 when he launched his campaign.
Okay, so what does it mean for next Friday? That is the deadline to reach some kind of border security deal, or the government could shut down again. Have the negotiations moved forward at all?
I was speaking with some of the negotiators here on Capitol Hill this morning, and the tone is optimistic. They were meeting this morning. It's a bipartisan group, Republicans and Democrats, and they were meeting with officials from Border Patrol and also from U.S. Customs. And, you know, what they took away from that meeting was not that they had concrete proposals, but they maybe had some areas that they could work on and continue to go back and forth in negotiations. Now, that being said, despite the optimism this morning, we are looking at Wednesday right now. It doesn't leave them a lot of time to come to agreement on this. So I think unless they really make strides in the next day or so, you know, we're getting into that territory of risking another government shutdown.
Ted Hassan covers immigration for Politico. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, Destination Crenshaw. It's an ambitious outdoor art project along the new metro line from LAX and celebrates African-American culture, but it could also speed up gentrification. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We all want better public transportation here in L.A., but when it comes to exactly where that will happen and what the effects on neighborhoods will be, well, then it becomes complicated. There's the temporary disruption, of course, brought by constructing a new metro line. And then there are the more permanent changes that come to a neighborhood with new transportation. Well, South LA is trying to make sure those changes will be positive. A rail line connecting LAX to the rest of Metro goes right through Crenshaw at street level. Not ideal for safety and other reasons, but local activists and artists are trying to make lemonade. They're creating something called Destination Crenshaw.
Destination Crenshaw is an open-air people's museum that runs along Crenshaw Boulevard, designed to celebrate the contributions of African Americans in Los Angeles to our city, to our state, our country, and world.
That's City Councilman Marquise Harris-Dawson. Here to talk about Destination Crenshaw is one of its planners, Naima Keith, Deputy Director and Chief Curator of the California African American Museum. Hi, Naima.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. And also joining us, Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's Design and Architecture Show DNA. Hi.
Hello, Madeline.
Naima, let's begin with you. Tell us about Destination Crenshaw. What is it?
So Destination Crenshaw is a 1.3-mile long, above-grade outdoor museum that will go along the Crenshaw LAX line on Crenshaw Boulevard. It will feature both permanent and rotating artwork that people can enjoy both when they're on the train or if they get off and want to see and learn a little bit more about Black Los Angeles.
And how did this all come together? What was the initial impetus?
The impetus actually is just actually what the council member said. There was the realization that the train was going to be above ground and rather than underground. And it was going to be right along a major thoroughfare. And so rather than, the community really fought, right, the train going above ground, but realizing that was going to happen, the council member decided to, just like you said, make lemonade, right? and what he likes to say is that turning insult into opportunity.
Right.
And really kind of thinking about how we can celebrate the community and also provide the visitors, with something to see. And that's amazing artwork that's already being produced in the community.
So you envision it, like people get off their planes at LAX, get their baggage, hop on the train, and they're whisked to wherever they're going through Crenshaw, and they see all this artwork?
Yes. But it's also an opportunity, I think, to celebrate the existing and thriving creative community that already exists along the Crenshaw corridor. So, yes, you're going to grab your bag, jump on the train. You may not necessarily be as familiar with L.A. or you may not necessarily be as familiar with the Crenshaw area. And so as you're kind of enjoying your ride, then you're kind of seeing, like I said, permanent and rotating outdoor sculpture that's going to celebrate the history of Black Los Angeles with the intention of, encourage people to come back, get off the train, walk around. There are going to be many, many pocket parks. There's going to be many opportunities for people just to walk along the street, to meander, to learn, to take in, like I said, the creative and the thriving community that's already there.
And Frances, you have done a lot of reporting on this, and you have interviewed the architect who's overseeing this from a design perspective. It's the same architect who oversaw the African American Museum in Washington.
That's right. I spoke with Zena Howard. She's a partner with Perkins & Will. Perkins & Will co-designed the Smithsonian African American Museum. Fantastic building. And what Zena told me what's so interesting about this challenge for her is that, in a way, what you get at Smithsonian is you get an actual building. What you're going to get at Destination Crenshaw is not an actual building, but you're going to get a built experience, which is going to involve walkways. It's going to involve parklets. It's going to involve some really interesting landscaping. But the difference between the two projects is while the Smithsonian was celebrating the larger African-American community, there wasn't a specific target client. While with Destination Crenshaw, the design process for her and all the others in the design team has been one of direct engagement with the community, teasing out what the community wants to see in that design, what they feel they need. Like, for example, trees, because tons of trees were uprooted, if you remember, back in 2012 when Space Shuttle Endeavour was paraded.
They were supposed to replant those trees. Did they not do that?
Well, there's going to be lots of trees is as part of Destination Crenshaw, as I understand. So anyway, what Zena says has been so interesting for her as the architect of this project is working with the community to figure out what's going to really make a great experience on this 1.3-mile open-air
museum.
So
it's not just for people traveling through. It's actually for the people who live there.
Yes, and just to piggyback off what you were saying in terms of community engagement, just to give you a real-life example, such as myself, I have been a part of the Curatorial Advisory Committee for 14 months. We've been meeting every quarter for 2 or 3 days at a time. For 14 months. And so it's not only just kind of hearing our feedback, and I'm actually an Angeleno, so I'm certainly speaking to someone who's grown up and lived around the Crenshaw area, but also soliciting community input and community support for, you know, for quite some time, nearly 2 years now. So this is definitely not something that's kind of popping up overnight or without, you know, the input from community members. So yes, I think this is both for, you know, commuters who are coming from LAX, but then also for the community that's living there to celebrate its own history. So it's definitely for both.
And then when it comes to the artists, the featured artists, you say there'd be like 100 or plus rotating and permanent art installations. We have a lot of celebrated African-American artists right here in Los Angeles. I can name two off the top of my head, Mark Bradford, Lauren Halsey. Would they be participating in this?
Well, I'm not allowed to give out the name, give out names right now, but I can definitely say that we'll be announcing the full artist list very, very soon. But there'll definitely be some well-known names, maybe one of which you've mentioned already. That's all I could say.
Okay, so I'm going to guess. I could guess it's either Lauren or Mark.
Or both.
Or both. She didn't
exactly.
say one. But.
No, but we've definitely...
but I know,
you know,
Lauren,
I think,
Halsey does public art, and she's very interested in that.
Yes, yes. But we've definitely tried to solicit both the larger names and the ones that have gotten more museum attention, but then also, like I said, local producers that have been doing amazing work, but just maybe underknown by a larger art-going public. So I think it's great that they're going to be in conversation with kind of larger names, if you will.
Gotcha. Okay, speaking of not well-known names, Francis, you spoke to some residents there. And what did they say about this project?
Well, my sense from talking to people is that there's a lot of excitement now in the neighborhood. However, there is that anxiety also percolating up, having to do with the effect that art is having in certain neighborhoods. One woman that we spoke with, Felice McInnes, she did raise the specter of gentrification. The Crenshaw neighborhood is changing. Its demographic is changing. And the train is going to bring more change. And this particular resident felt that Destination Crenshaw might actually intensify that change.
Well, it's going to bring more people to the community. Some of it good. I feel some of it might not be so good because, you know, when places become more popular, the rents go up, unfortunately, and that's the bad side of the whole thing. I just wish the experience could be enriching, but keep it so we can stay here.
Okay, Naima, what are the concerns about that gentrification? In the LA Times, Earl Ofari Hutchison, who's a longtime activist, liver, and resident of the community, said this will not halt gentrification.
I actually agree. Again, I'm an Angeleno. I live blocks away from Crenshaw Boulevard, and I'm seeing the changes happening every day. Right, so. While the train, I agree, will certainly bring a level of attention and maybe speed up one's awareness of the area, I don't necessarily know if it's going to change what's already happening, right? But the point, I think, of Destination Crenshaw is to both celebrate and also kind of remind people of the rich history that's been in the community for a very long time. So I think that even though those changes are going to happen, I think it's about planting those roots and letting those, you know, letting people know that there has been an active and thriving African-American presence in this area for quite some time. And that so that when new people do move in, that there is a sense of the place that they're moving into.
Okay. And just give us a quick timeline when this is going to happen. Has it all been funded?
It's going to be like officially unveiled spring 2020, so a year from now. And again, in anticipation of the train. And the artists will be announced later on this year. And then in terms of funding, there'll be plenty of opportunities for major sponsorship, but also gifts. If anyone is interested in either sponsoring individual projects or giving to Destination Crenshaw as a whole.
All right. Thank you very much. Best of luck. Can't wait to see what it turns out to look like. It's very exciting.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Naima Keith, Deputy Director and Chief Curator of the California African American Museum, and Frances Anderton, host of KCRW's DNA. Thanks, Frances.
You're very welcome, Madeline.
Coming up, KCRW's Michael Silverblad has some book recommendations for you.
This is a book in which we watch people trying to make the world better, and the world, being the world, refuses to get any better.
The Bookworm, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Today, we're trying out a brand new segment for our show. We're calling it the Bookworm of the Month Club. To make that work, of course, we're going to need a bookworm. Fortunately, we have one, our own.
Where could you find one?
Michael
so
Silverblad.
Rare.
I know. There's only the one that I know. Okay, so you're going to bring a book or two for us every month or so. And today, we're starting off with a memoir by a guy named Tosh Berman. The memoir is called Tosh, Growing Up in Wallace Berman's World, and Wallace Berman is his father. Tell us more about Wallace Berman.
Wallace Berman was the primary example, the most famous example of Los Angeles assemblage art. The whole collage movement based around assemblage began out here in L.A. and traveled to New York, and he was thought to be not only the best, but the most famous. Mm. He was a very silent man. He lived in Topanga. He never in his entire career gave an interview about his work.
Really?
He refused to, yes.
Why? Did he have a principle about that?
Yes, he didn't believe in it. He believed that the art should speak to you, not the artist. No. And the other great fascinating thing about Wallace Berman, the father, is after he gave his first gallery show, it was raided by the cops, some kind of obscenity charge, and he never, ever, for the rest of his life, had a solo show in a gallery again. He only sold his work in group shows and only to people who he liked. He didn't want strangers owning his stuff.
Yeah.
In other words, this was a different picture of Los Angeles art. We've got our artists, you know, getting agents and galleries. Wallace Berman was the opposite. He was born in 1926, and you know what, Madeline? He died on the very day of his 50th birthday in 1976.
What did he die of?
He was run over by a drunk driver in Topanga Canyon where the family lived.
So this book by his son is an appreciation of him. It's about growing up with him.
It's not just that. It's about what it's like to grow up in the L.A. art community between the beat years and the counterculture years. So as people were visiting Los Angeles to teach at UCLA, and this includes Marcel Duchamp, Larry Rivers, all kinds of really great artists, they get to know Wallace and the Los Angeles artists and Topanga, lonely, beautiful Topanga. It's the home of the L.A. artists of the time. But for a kid, for a boy, you can't get anywhere in Topanga without a car.
I know. You know what? My father lived in Topanga.
I
had that same experience.
His mother did not drive, and his father used to like to wait until there were a number of errands, the laundry, the groceries, this and that. And so he was stuck at home, you know.
But what a great home to be stuck in, because he was probably surrounded by art and nature and adventure.
Yes, yes. But, you know, not even the bookworm, Michael Silverblad, like to be completely surrounded by art. I wanted my parents to take me to see Lady and the Tramp at the very least.
Yeah, maybe a trip to Disneyland. I guess I'm guessing that was not in the offing for Tosh. So what was it like growing up with this famous, or at least artistically famous, eccentric dad?
Well, there's a beautiful picture on the cover of the book. This little Tosh raising his hands, his father, bearded, next to him, also raising his hands as if the cops are saying, hold on there. And his father always acted, Tosh says, something like a wanted man, as if there were a secret.
And there's a portrait of a woman behind them.
That
Who
is
that?
The mother. Uh-huh. Her name was Shirley. She was she's still alive, a very beautiful woman.
And how did she figure into this memoir?
Well, it's very interesting that you bring that up. This is the period when the artists are not treating the women very well. The women are going out to work. The women are bringing home the groceries, and the women are cooking, too. So even Tosh is acknowledging that as interesting as it was to grow up in a bohemian household, that this was not the best way for his mother to be treated.
So it sounds like Los Angeles is almost as big a character in this book as Tosh's father, as Tosh, as his mother. What did you learn about Los Angeles reading this book?
Absolutely. Madeline, this should have been called Growing Up in Wallace Berman's Los Angeles. I didn't know the bohemian Los Angeles at that time. I didn't know that the place where people were hitchhiking up and down the street was Sunset Boulevard, Sunset Strip. I also didn't know what beat Los Angeles was like. And of all the books I've read about L.A. since I've gotten here, this was the most informative about the L.A. I would have wanted to know.
All right. Let us look at the second book that you brought in, which is pretty much seems like the opposite, or at least it takes place on the opposite coast. Right. Hark by Sam Lipsight. And he's a New Yorker. He teaches writing at Columbia. What is this novel about?
Hark is about a man named Hark because his mother has thought that the song Hark the Herald Angels Sing is someone telling someone named Hark that the angels are singing.
So it's a funny novel.
It is funny and it's a sardonic book. Now, Hark might as well be one of the herald angels. He comes and is discovered, and he has these theories about mental archery, that by practicing mental archery, you will be able to improve your life.
And what is mental archery?
The mental archery is using the premise that was used by William Tell. William Tell was made to shoot an apple off the top of his son's head. Well, Hark knows the difference between the apple and the son's head. In reaching your goals, you have to shoot the apple, not shoot the son's head. And he's trying to teach people how to set their goals and how to assume yoga-like postures that will allow them to hit their goal instead of kill their son.
Now, this is being advertised as a satirical novel. What is it satirizing?
It's satirizing the belief that ideas can change the world. It's taking the teachings of this man named Hark. Eventually, by Webb, he gathers thousands of adherents who are practicing mental archery. And of course, no matter how much mental archery you're practicing, it doesn't change climate change. It doesn't change the horror you may feel about your political candidates in office or out of office. And so this is a book in which we watch people trying to make the world better, and the world being the world refuses to get any better.
But it also sounds like it's saying, look, you guys, stop focusing on yourself and start focusing outward, because that's where the true change comes from.
Yes, that is true. And more than that, start understanding that when you stop thinking about yourself, you can think outward. All of us have forgotten this, but this Hark lectures the rich by essentially asking, who needs to be a billionaire? Why would all that money be necessary? And what could you possibly buy with it? What is the goal of these impractical, entirely materialist goals? So although it's a satirical novel, it's also an idealistic novel. It's a novel asking, can we have better goals?
I think we can.
Well, I hope so. What I liked about this, it's by an author named Sam Lipsight. He won the very first prize that the McSweeney's magazine gave to a novelist for one of his earlier books. Now, beat me, but I didn't like that book. I found this book really funny, really peculiar, surprisingly rambling in its disclosures. It meanders. It's a book that just wants to amuse and or shock you as many times as it can and as suddenly as it can. It is an anarchic novel about our times. Is there something that we might be able to do to improve our times?
And so that sounds like a very optimistic way to end our first segment. Let's hope that there is a way to improve our times. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Madeline. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. I've missed you so much.
Well, fortunately, you'll be back. Michael Silverblatt, he's host of Bookworm on KCRW. You can hear him right after Press Play at 2 o'clock on Thursdays. And the two books we discussed are Hark by Sam Lipsight and Tosh, Growing Up in Wallace Berman's World by Tosh Berman. Coming up, California is finally getting into the truffle business. We'll speak with a farmer about her first truffle crop next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
This magical tasting fungi is by weight one of the most expensive foods in the world. It's phenomenal eaten raw, shaped over pasta or risottos, or a drizzle of truffle oil turns slow-cooked stews into something out of this world.
Oh, yes, the wonderful, delectable black truffle, a.k.a. the black diamond of the kitchen. That's Chef Gordon Ramsay raving about it. The finest black truffles, or Perigord truffles, come from France. Well, unlike wine, California has been unable to compete. Until now, California is having its first truffle season ever. Joining us now is truffle farmer Stacey O'Toole. She owns a truffle orchard in Placerville. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm great. Well, how long have you been trying to grow truffles?
Well, I started the company Truffle Hunters about 5.5 years ago. And it was a trained truffle dog, Mila, my little truffle huntress. And we were going around from orchard to orchard, helping those individuals who had planted their truffiers try to find their first truffles. And in 2016, we went to a truffier in El Dorado County, found the first truffle in nearly a decade in California, and the gentleman asked us, who was getting ready to retire, if we wanted to buy a truffle orchard, and we did.
Just like that, because you found one truffle, you're all in?
Well, my husband wasn't so all in, but it took me about 6 months to convince him that it was going to be a fabulous property, and he figured, well, worst case scenario, I'd be busy in the truffle orchard, and we have a lovely property in El Dorado County, and lo and behold, we got our first truffles this year, so everyone was quite shocked, including him.
Oh, wow. Why has it been so hard to grow truffles in California?
Well, you know, it's really experimental science or experimental farming. The truffle trees that come from the nurseries are inoculated on hazelnuts and oaks, and that part is fabulous. There's great nurseries. However, once they get in the ground, it's a lot of guesswork. So we're starting to work with a lot of scientists who've been spending a lot of research on it, and we're starting to dial it in finally. It's not 100%, but we're getting close.
Well, describe how it works, because they're in the ground, but you're saying you need special trees?
Correct. What happens is the root of the tree forms an ectomycorrhizal relationship with the fungus. And so in the nursery, they take baby acorns for oaks or hazelnuts, and they go ahead and they inoculate the roots with the fungus. They grow it in a medium, and then they confirm that the fungus has been infected on the roots. It's a symbiotic relationship, we think, more or less. And so then those trees are, when they're about a year to 2 years old, they're planted in the ground. You have to bring your pH up to a certain level by adding limestone or various different calcium carbonate, things of that nature. And then you kind of just hope and pray that you're doing the right thing. You're watering it the right amount, getting it enough sunshine. So,
and do your truffles taste different from the French truffles?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We've been saying that from a DNA standpoint, they're identical. But not unlike anything else, there's a terroir. So if you have a soil that is slightly different than another soil, it's going to have a taste differential. And we're seeing that. And actually, research has shown very recently that there is a difference in terroir. I have to say that the chefs that have compared my truffles to European truffles have chosen mine, hands down, all two of them.
two truffles or two chefs? Okay.
Because we only pulled like a pound out of the ground. So, you know, it's just brand new.
Wow, that's exciting. How much is one truffle?
So, you know, it depends. We're finding them anywhere from the biggest one we found was 3.7 ounces this year, which is the size of like a baseball. It's, you know, it's a pretty good size. And then we found them literally as small as a pea.
And how much would you get for a baseball size truffle?
The chefs are paying somewhere around $800 to $900 a pound. And it was interesting, as I mentioned before, the one chef that I did work with at a restaurant here locally, he was willing to pay a premium over the French Perigord. So I was pretty happy about that. He paid about a 25% premium over the French Perigord. So, yeah, I know. It's kind of crazy. And then, you know, if you're going retail, they're probably closer to like $1,400 or $1,500 a pound.
Oh my gosh. So for one baseball sized truffle, that's around $225 for the chef.
Correct. Yeah. Okay. But they can get a ton of use out of it. One of the things that people don't realize with truffles is you can use it to infuse a lot of foods before you actually use it to shave on something or to grate on something or to make a sauce or whatever you might be using it for. So you can infuse dozens of eggs and cream cheese and butter. And there's so many ways that you can use it to add layering of flavor. So it sounds crazy, but it's actually got a lot of value from that standpoint.
Oh my gosh. My mouth is literally watering right now just listening to that.
I'm doing my job then.
You are. Okay.
I'm a truffle pusher.
You are. Thanks a lot, Stacy.
You're so welcome.
That's Stacy O'Toole. She's a farmer. She owns a truffle orchard in El Dorado County. And that's it for us here at Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.